Welcome back to Alphabet Scoop. This is episode 30, the big 3-0. We've been doing this a really long time now. And I guess this is probably our fifth or sixth episode where the first part of our headline is Pixel 3.
Oh, way more.
I don't know if you guys heard, but Google launched a phone called the Pixel 3 recently. It's pretty good. It's a pretty good phone.
But welcome to Issues Week, as is cyclical.
Yeah, so every year with every phone, there's issues, and the last couple of years have not been any exception for the Pixel line, especially last year. Last year was probably, I don't know, it was both fun and just depressing to cover all of the problems that the Pixel 2, especially the XL, had. I think we did like 5 to 10 articles about the screen itself, and thankfully it looks like that's not the case this year. It looks like the Pixels generally don't seem to have any major flaws, but that doesn't stop people from picking them apart, which people have. So I guess we can take a deep dive into that first this week. One of the things I guess we could talk about first, and since we talked about it already last week, I believe, is the RAM management issue. So Artem, I think, a couple guys, journalists at a couple other sites all mentioned that the Pixel 3 just has this weird RAM or memory management problem. And there have been a lot of theories as to what might be causing it. Maybe some kind of, the battery feature that was introduced with Android P, adaptive battery, that might be a potential reason. There's lots of different theories as to why this might be happening, but what's happening is that people are trying to use their phones and trying to listen to music and take photos at the same time, and the Pixel 3 just doesn't like that, it seems.
Oh yeah, I've definitely, so when I'm taking pictures and listening to music, I've had music stop, but more recently I've just been listening to music, and then it automatically stops. My problems with YouTube music a lot of times. Have you encountered anything similar?
It's happened once. So there was one point where I was listening to Spotify, and I went to the camera app and took a photo, and it stopped. But I have to say that, I'm not apologizing for this, because I think that it's a problem, and I think especially since the Pixel 2 XL doesn't seem to share this issue, shows that this is a Pixel 3 problem, especially since, yeah, you know, they both have 4 gigs of RAM. It doesn't seem like this is a 4 gigs of RAM problem, which is basically, I think, the conclusion that a lot of people were jumping to. But personally, just the way I use my phone on a daily basis, there have not been many cases where I've encountered this. And maybe that's just a testament to how I use my phone and not necessarily whether or not the problem exists, because I don't typically listen to music and take photos at the same time. And so, mm-hmm. If that's the case where people are seeing this problem pop up often, then, it just hasn't affected me. So I guess for me as a normal user of the phone, honestly, if I had not read the headlines this week and I had just, if I just were using my phone as a normal person, and just using it, I wouldn't have noticed any of the problems that have been mentioned, even the microphone thing. So like the microphone thing is obvious when you compare it side by side with the iPhone XS or Pixel 2 even, which also had not so great of a microphone. But honestly, I don't record videos that often either. So it's like, that's another kind of thing that's in that category where for me, I didn't notice it because I'm not vlogging with my phone all the time.
But vlogging is a very valid use case for many people increasingly.
Absolutely.
Honestly, it's the audience that Google wants to attract. It's the creative types, the influencers, and they'll notice it and they'll be vocal about it.
Yeah. So, I'm not saying that any of these things are not problems. I think it's our job to bring as many of these minor issues to Google's attention as possible, and but I'm just so glad that this year it seems like these things are minor, and even the things that are not so minor, like,
it's bugs. It's bugs rather than systemic issues with display panel that Google chose and cannot be replaced for the hundreds and thousands of people who bought them. So it's software.
Or quality control problems where phones are coming out of the factory defective. You know, like that. Yeah. That's a whole other thing. The microphone thing is software. The RAM management thing is software. You know, what other issues did we have? Let's see, fast charging thing. We can get into that in a minute. But a lot of these things are software fixable, and none of that. It obviously doesn't guarantee that Google will fix every single thing the way we would want them to fix them, because you know, there's sometimes things where, you know, for instance, in the microphone issue, it's like, I think Google was being disingenuous in saying that this is, you know, that the microphone was tuned to be this way. I don't think that's necessarily.
Oh, the speakers.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't think the speakers are going to be changed. I think that's another thing. I feel like some of these things, Google is like, yeah, we knew about this when we were, you know, producing or working on the phone, and we're just owning it. You know, we're owning it, and we're trying to make it as good as possible. But you know, we've done our best, and I think the speakers is probably one of those things. I don't think that they're going to change the way that these drivers or these speakers are outputting audio. On the microphone thing, that does seem like something they would fix. But I think it's definitely one of those cases where it's like, you know, for those that aren't aware, the microphone on the back of the Pixel 3 or top of the Pixel 3 just sounds like it's coming through a tin can. Basically, it sounds terrible. It basically just loses all the low. It seems like they're just stripping out. Like the Google's explanation was they're stripping out background or trying to strip out background noise. But it just results in this sound that sounds terrible and just tinny. So that's the kind of thing that I think Google is going to say. Yeah, that was on purpose. We totally did that on purpose. That was a tuning thing. And then in a couple weeks when Android 8.1 or whatever. Whatever the next version is, it'll be like quietly fixed and we'll never hear about it or talk about it ever again.
Yeah, we're expecting a security update in 2 weeks, so I'm sure they'll start tackling those issues very quickly.
Yeah. I mean, I think that none of the issues, and this couldn't have been said last year, none of the issues are something that I would say...
it's a deal breaker. Yeah.
Right, like makes me reconsider my conclusion from the review, which was buy the phone, or at least put qualifiers on it. It's not like, yeah, the Pixel 3 is a great phone, except you're always going to have these weird RAM problems. It's like, nah, I think this is something that Google's going to work out, and it's going to be fine. I've gotten emails actually for the last couple of weeks. I've been getting emails like, hey, I've been seeing all these issues like about Pixel 3, all these things people are talking about. It bothers me, concerns me, you know, should I not buy the phone? And my answer to that is, you absolutely should buy the phone because I don't think any of these problems are going to be problems in the long run. Although they do deserve to be brought to light right now. Go ahead.
I was going to jump into the power issues.
Yes.
So wireless charging. The only way to get fast wireless charging at 10 watts is using the Pixel stand. Google is using a proprietary standard, Handshake, that requires special hardware in order to have the Pixel 3 charge at the highest speeds and capacity. And for many people with existing 10 watt and above charges, this is a great pain.
Yeah. For those that don't know, Qi as a standard does support, you know, more than 5 watts. It exists. But in Google's case, the Pixel stand is charging at 10 watts via a proprietary protocol or technology of some sort that's not Qi. Or it's like built on top of Qi. At least that's the understanding that I got from something that Ron tweeted yesterday. But the problem on the consumer side of things is that it is, you have to buy the $80 charger if you want to charge at the full speed. And that seems like an arbitrary limitation.
In fairness, Google is opening up this proprietary technology. Belkin is making a $60 wireless charger, but again, it's $60. And the optics don't look good at all. So I have this Samsung fast charger, and when I put my Pixel 3 on it, it says charging rapidly. it appears whatever wireless charger you put your Pixel 3 on, it'll say charging rapidly, and it's very...
The verbiage is not necessarily reflective of what's actually happening. And it's been that the whole verbiage of charging rapidly, I don't know, that's not exactly had the best track record of accurately portraying what's actually happening. I think I'm not exactly sure what the the tiers of what determines that notification to be triggered versus just charging. But even with wired chargers, it was weird some cases where it was like, at least in my experience, where I was like, it should definitely be charging at full capacity, and it's not showing charging rapidly. And then you plug it into the first party Pixel USB-C adapter or charger, and it would say charging rapid. So you're right. Like, there's not like much consistency there, and that's probably misleading because it makes people think that using any charger is charging just as fast as a Pixel Stand would. Maybe they should change the thing for Pixel Stand to charging super rapidly or something.
Another premium.
But yeah, I don't know. It's frustrating and annoying, and you know, Qi in spirit should be an open standard, and it should be that. I'm okay with the proprietary aspect of the Pixel Stand features though. When it comes to the software side of things, I think it's okay. It doesn't really bother me that you can only access this Pixel Stand UI on the ambient display unless you have the hardware. I don't know. Pixel Stand in general is like, it's cool, and I really like the photo frame aspect of things. But you know, it's kind of hard to recommend. I only barely touched on it in my first review, and I'm going to do a standalone separate review for the Pixel Stand. But the more I think about it, it's really hard to recommend at $80. For the reason of, you know, the software features that you get are, you know, not necessarily, they don't have to be exclusive. They are, but they don't have to be. And I mean, there's plenty of chargers that give you 5-watt charging, for $20. So I don't know. It's a tough one. I would hope that this might be another thing that Google, I don't know. We'll see how this ends up, but I don't think that this is the kind of thing that Google can just push a software update and be like, oops. Mm-hmm. So it looks like we're stuck with the situation where it's like, yeah, $20, you can get a normal wireless charger at 5 watts, or you can spend $80 and get the Pixel Stand, which does 10 watts, and you can get these assistant features and the photo frame thing. Yeah, it's a hard sell for me. That's preview on my review is, I don't know if this is a really good buy for most people. With the exception of people who are getting $50 back on Google Store for pre-ordering the Pixel 3, if you got that $50 and can Pixel Stand for 30, that's a steal. But I think the Pixel Stand should be 30 for everyone.
Oh, yeah. It should have been a pre-order gift, honestly. I don't know why
the Google Store. Yeah, it was with some carriers.
Yeah, $50.
So, what other issues were there?
That's mostly it. There was the Verizon Google Pixel 3 was SIM locked briefly, but I think the outcry caused Verizon and Google or some match of those to collect it. But yeah, that's mostly the issues for now. I'm sure as more and more people start to get their units, we'll definitely hear some issues, and we'll definitely cover these issues.
Absolutely. And if there are any issues that you're having with your phone, be sure to let us know in the comments on YouTube here or over at 95 Google. We'll be sure to look into anything that anyone brings up. Another interesting thing is just today, actually, Droid Life did a poll asking, you know, what issues are you having with your Pixel 3? And like almost every comment was like, none, none, none. It's fine. It's cool. We're good. Like Pixel 3 is fine. And I mean, that's my experience too. I think a lot of these things are going to affect specific use cases for specific subsections of people who would buy the phone. And even then, they're temporary. So I think that pretty much pretty much sums up Pixel 3 issues, and I'm very glad that that's the conclusion this year. It's good news for Google, and it's good news for next year too. Hopefully. Another thing on Pixel 3 this week was Night Sight. So XDA, was it a modded APK of the camera app? Was that?
Yep.
Modded. Yeah. So a modded APK of the camera app, and they managed to enable Night Sight somehow. So they pushed that out, and it's crazy.
It is. I think you mentioned it, but Google should really provide a technical explanation of how they're leveraging machine learning to do this, because that would make an interesting read.
Yeah, we for sure. What's up?
Be sure to check out our photos. Our colleague Ben took some comparison shots before and after with Flash, and they are really impressive.
Yeah, like you said, I'm really interested to see what the technology is, or what it is exactly that Google's doing with this. Interestingly, one thing to note is that it's not limited to the visual core. So there's nothing that's happening with the hardware in the Pixel 3 that makes Night Sight possible. It looks like this modded camera app works just as well on the Pixel 1, Pixel 2, and Pixel 3.
And officially, it's coming to all those devices, the Pixel 1 and the Pixel 2.
Yeah, so that's one interesting aspect. It's like, you know, it must mean that this is purely software based. And so I guess one thing that I'm curious is, like, how is this, like, what exactly is the AI doing? Is the AI looking at this and looking at the photo and then basically, you know, applying what would be 10 minutes of post-product or post edits in Photoshop? Is that what's happening, or is there something happening when the image is actually captured that changes the actual raw photo that's being taken? It seems like this is all, I don't know, I can't really tell by looking at the photos, but it seems like it's all it's just taking a photo and then it's just happening. And then, yeah, so I don't, it'll be interesting to see Google detail how it all works, but good news for anyone that bought a Pixel 1 and Pixel 2, that you'll get this too. It's fascinating, and it's really crazy how well it captures these low light photos. The photos that Google showed off at 10.9, which was the 10S side by side with Pixel 3 of that night shot, is actually 100% how these things look. That demo was not exaggerated at all. We'll have more thoughts on that whenever we learn more.
It feels strange that this wasn't a launch feature. Like, I think that compared to photo booth, I think this is slightly more interesting for more people.
Yeah. Yeah. I thought about that. It seems pretty finished too. Like, I wonder what held it back from being available on day one, because, you know, XDA enabled it and it seems pretty fully functional. So, yeah, I don't know. Also, Pixel 3 Top Shot saves photos in reduced resolution but keeps subject quality. So that's another topic on the camera. Maybe you can tell us a little bit about that.
So Top Shot is this feature that uses motion photos to save the best frames. So if the best photo was just a second before you captured the shutter button, the Pixel 3 will also save that image. If it's doing this all the time, it obviously can't save them in full resolution. So it's doing this smart analysis of sorts where the subject will retain the higher quality in HDR and other aspects, but something like the background or like glass or anything like that will just be reduced in a way that's not too noticeable. But we posted some side by side shots where you can see it. But overall, it's, I think people will prefer that photo having been saved rather than not having it at all.
Yeah, I definitely think the trade-off of having a good shot is worth maybe the shot losing a little bit of resolution.
And everything's shared on Instagram and social networks. It's, maybe it doesn't matter.
That's true. Anything else on Pixel 3? I mean, there were a couple of ads. They were really cool. Today's Mr. Rogers ad. It was just like, I mean, I loved it because it felt like an Apple ad.
Yeah.
It really felt like one of those purely emotional appeal Apple ads.
And it wasn't too heavy on the actual product. It wasn't like feature after feature after feature. It just focused on Google Lens. It barely touched on the camera. And this focused approach is nice. It works. It's human.
Yeah, I think that's the kind of ad that really sells these phones to the average person. I mean, my wife, like, she's like, every time she sees these Pixel 3 ads, like, you know, we've been watching Hulu or whatever every night, and we have ad supported Hulu, and we'll see, like, because we live in a home that we Google things about Google all the time, it's targeting me, I'm sure. And so between we're watching like Shark Tank or something, and it's like every 10 minutes we'll get like 3 Pixel 3 ads, and she's just like not impressed at all with like these, like, you know, pans and zooms of the phone and showing off how cool it looks and like the hardware of it. But anytime there's like an iPhone ad that's just like a cute little love story or something that shows absolutely nothing about the device or about the phone, like, she's just like, I need that. I think there's definitely a subsection of people that really can get pulled in by that kind of ad. Also, the hardware store pop-up in Soho opened up this week. You can check out the Pixel 3, Pixel 3 XL, Google Home Hub, and Pixel Slate, and all of other Google's hardware. I've heard that they're only selling the phone on Verizon at these stores, which is so silly. Like, if you want to buy a phone at the Google store, you cannot buy it outside of Verizon.
So what's funny with these ads are how, like, the Verizon's ads say exclusively on Verizon,
It's such a bad, man, that must be part of the contract, because that's so misleading.
But a key part of the contract allows Project Fi to exist. Yeah. So
it's not true because you can use it on any carrier. Two, it's not true because it's literally sold through Project Fi.
That either says a lot about Project Fi or Verizon. Yeah.
All right, well, I guess we can talk about the Google Home Hub now, which last week was Pixel 3 review embargoes, and this week was Google Home Hub review embargoes. I can say pretty confidently that next Monday will not be Pixel Slate embargoes, so don't get your hopes up on that, but do expect that in the coming weeks.
And you have your weekends free again for a few weeks.
Yes, I was pretty slammed the last two weekends because I'm not a video guy. Like, a lot of people noticed and a lot of people commented, like, man, you really need to work on your video editing skills. And yes, I do. I know. Like, I hear you. I absolutely know that my videos are not great from a production standpoint. But that's what I've been doing the last couple weekends, because every year around this time, I try to push myself to do a few videos. Just because, you know, I'm slowly year over year building those skills out. A couple weekends ago, I spent the whole weekend on Pixel 3. This past weekend, I was working on Home Hub. And my review, I mean, I don't really know what to say about Google Home Hub, because
it's so cheap. When you get to a certain price point, it's there's no risk in recommending or even buying one.
Yeah, this is in the category of Insta buy to me. Yeah. I think just the same way Google Home Mini was, and just the same way Chromecast is. It's another Google hardware product that's like, there's no way not to recommend this. I wasn't smart enough to think of this, but I loved The Verge's angle on the review, which was like, this is the best digital photo frame. Mm-hmm. That you can buy, period. I actually didn't really focus that much on the digital photo frame aspect of the Google Home Hub, because for me, I mean, I was just, you know, maybe not thinking about that, but for me, it's not a super huge selling point for me. Having the photo frame is nice, and I like the Pixel Stand photo frame, so I'm not anti-photo frame, but I just didn't think about that as like being a really big selling point of this device for most people. And I completely agree. Like, it wasn't that long ago, I don't know if you remember, but you would go into Walmart and buy a digital photo frame for like $100. And it was like a crappy piece of plastic with a little 5x7 LCD. And you had to plug your USB stick into it. And it would just circulate between 30 photos. And you paid $100 for that. And grandmas across the country bought them in mass.
Grandma plugging in the USB port. That's a funny image.
Well, grandkids plugging it in for grandma. when they give them the gift of the digital photo frame. But yeah, I completely agree with that. It's like the best photo frame you can buy, and it's only $150. So it's not that far off from, you know, just buying a crappy photo frame. And on top of that, it's a Google Home, and it does all the Google Home things, and the kitchen use cases are so, you know, wide reaching, and the bedroom use cases, it's like, it's awesome. Like everything about it is Google Home, but better, I think. I guess there's one thing that Google Home Hub is not better than the rest of Google Homes at, and that's audio output, which is a big deal for Google Home because, you know, Google Home Max is all about music. It's all about making the best speaker possible. Google's been just taking Google Home, like the platform, and trying different things. The original was like the kitchen Google Home, which is good for everything. It's the all-around Google Home. I have one in my bathroom right now, and I use it every time I take a shower to listen to music. You know, I've got Google Home Minis in every room, and you know, the Google Home was that. It was the everyman's Google Home, I guess. And it was priced right, $129. It still is $129, by the way, which we talked about a couple weeks ago. It, you know, it's great. Google Home Mini was, we need to take this exact product and make it as cheap as possible, and also make it, you know, not be ugly and not, you know, have a terrible speaker. The speaker's pretty bad, but it's not unusable. And then Home Max was, take the same platform and put it on the best speaker possible, and who cares about the price? Price ended up being $400, which it still is. And the Home Hub, I think, is Google Home, the original Google Home, but better in every way except speakers. I would say it's up there. It's better than Home Mini, but not as good as the regular Google Home. But in terms of using the Home for what you use a Home for, which is timers, you know, listening to music, except for the speakers, you know, they're great, but you know, they're not amazing. They're usable. You know, a lot of those basic everyday use cases. I mean, timers, man, like timers are 90% of my Google Home usage. I don't know about you, but it's like in the kitchen and I'm setting timers 5 times a day because I'm cooking all the time. Maybe I cook more than the average person, but you know, I set a lot of timers on that thing. And having the visual, you know, the visual supplement to what Google Home used to do for me is great to have. So
yeah. So I've gotten my unit, my personal unit, and I love the clock. I just love the having a gigantic clock. It's replacing my Sony whatever thing, digital alarm clock, and having a big screen and having it double as a remote for casting is super awesome.
Yeah. Do you use it in your bedroom?
Living room. But
okay.
I'm thinking about moving it to a bedroom because the screen is fantastic. It can get the low light, the ambient EQ sensor is really good at just faintly displaying text in a way that's not disturbing compared to, again, like standard alarm clocks. So the resolution is like 1024 by 6 something. But this is, one, it's 6 inches. 2, you're viewing it from far away. But 3, what Google is doing to adjust to any source of lighting in terms of color, it's brilliant.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. I think the display is really gorgeous. And that's why one of the things, you know, that's why I mentioned the photo frame, digital photo frame thing. It's like, it's perfect for that. And it's so much easier to, I mean, I love that Google Photos can just pull, you know, it's like pulling just whatever, the best photos. And like, and I've been using that on my Pixel stand for a couple of weeks. And I have my Pixel stand on my desk, actually. So I keep an eye on that photo frame throughout the day for the last week or so, and it's not great at like choosing photos. Like, you know, you can tell that it's not random, but it's not great. It's like picking up like random selfies from like a year ago, you know, in some cases, like, or, you know, and like not even good selfies. It was like, I bought the iPhone 10 and I was testing out like the portrait mode or whatever. And it's like showing selfies of me just like testing that out, which is like, no, I don't care about that photo at all anymore. So, you know, the algorithm needs to learn how to filter out iPhone 10 demo photos. It's not perfect. Yeah, but.
I guess in regards to the photo frame aspect, so we were talking about how people put photos in a USB stick and do it manually. Is Google Photos, is it good enough to try, and is it more convenient than having to like manually curate your album, or would most people just rely on this AI and just have it go at your full photo library? Because I don't want it going to all my photo library.
No, I don't either. I don't want it to go into my entire photo library. Cause I mean, for one, I'm a tech reviewer and I'm taking phones.
Screenshots.
I'm taking screenshots and I'm taking photos with phones all the time that are just garbage and mean nothing to me. And just they're automatically being uploaded to Google Photos because it's just easier that way. So for me, it makes no sense. And that's probably part of why maybe my experience with the photo frame on both the Google Home Hub and the Pixel Stand is just not great, because there's tons of stuff in my photos library that is just completely irrelevant. But I think for maybe most people, I mean, I've noticed this, and when I've like looked at other people's phones and like scrolled through their photos or whatever, even my wife, I look through her photo library and it's much more curated and like, or naturally not curated, but like she's like much better about like deleting the garbage and like,
really?
Like deleting the garbage and also just not taking crappy photos in the first place. Like she's much more selective about what photos she'll take. Whereas I'm just like taking my phone out and just like snapping stuff all the time carelessly. Yeah. And it's like maybe 1 out of 10 will be good, but it's okay if there's 9 that are crap. And she's more tactful, I should say, with taking photos in general. And so her library is a lot less terrible than mine. I think there probably are people out there that probably have half decent libraries on Google Photos that, you know, just using the AI to pick randomly, or not so randomly, but, you know, intelligently, pick from the library might actually be not bad. And even for me, it's not terrible. I mean, even right now I'm looking at it right now and it's got a photo of my dog, and the last one was a photo of me and my wife on a recent trip we took. So, you know, it does okay. But I do think that the ability to choose a manually created
album.
Yeah. It's probably better for a lot of people. Especially for me. So that's my thoughts on that. I don't know. Is there anything else on Google Home that anyone has questions about that maybe you can just quickly ask in the chat on YouTube that maybe I can touch on before we move on? Because I feel like there's just, I don't know. I really like the Google Home, and I think it's like, honestly, the best product that Google launched this year.
Yeah, and I think most people are buying it during the holidays. I don't think they're buying it now. A phone is an instant purchase, but I think most people are waiting to get the smart displays.
It's just such a no-brainer purchase, and it's so good. Someone said the mic. Go ahead. What's up?
I was going to say the bezel bothers me. I can't get over it.
Oh, yes. The white bezel on the black.
Yeah, charcoal. I have the same unit. No, good.
That was the one that Google sent to most of the reviewers, it looked like.
Just odd. Color buttons work so much better.
It's like, that's like the worst one. Like, why would you? Maybe it was just the one they had the most abundance of. I don't know. But okay, so that actually, this is a thought that I did have that I should note that I had mentioned in the review. I think the black is gross. The black and white, I mean, like the black with white display is just like not attractive. But I will say that in my week or so with it before I wrote, or less than a week, I actually only had the Home Hub for 4 days before I had to publish my review and video. But in those 4 days, what I'd noticed was the Home Mini was one, very small, like it's smaller than you think. And we mentioned that in our hands-on too. But the Home Hub is small, and it's smaller than you think. And then the other thing is the display covers much of the body. So if it's sitting on like a counter in the kitchen, for instance, which is where mine is right now, the display covers so much of the body that you really only see a tiny, if you're looking at it dead on, you really only see like a tiny little strip below the display of the actual body of the device. And my kitchen's not so well lit, so I don't really see the back of it ever, even at like an angle. So in my case specifically, and I think a lot of people's cases in kitchens, you're probably not going to be able to see the body of the device that often. So I don't think that the color you pick for your Home Hub is as important as you might think. Like it's interesting to me. There's four colors available for the Google Home Hub, but I think this device is the one that matters the least. Like, they could have launched just a white one or just a black one, and I think it would have been fine, because at least in my case in the kitchen, I don't ever see the back of it. It's just that white display on the front that I see for the majority of the time. Maybe it would be different if it were in my bedroom or something, but
not by much.
I found myself not caring about the black. I think, like, you know, taking shots of it on my desk and trying to make a video of it, I don't like the black and white look, but in actual use, I don't think the color matters at all. So if you're grueling over which color Home Hub to pick,
then, and the fact that chalk at the good colors, pink and blue, are only available on the Google store. Yeah, just get it wherever you can get a sale, a deal.
Yeah, I would agree. Just any of the colors are really fine. I don't think you're really going to notice it that much. Mm-hmm. I don't think there's anything else to talk about on Google Home Hub that I can think of. I probably will think of things as soon as this podcast ends that I wanted to touch on. I haven't really used it for video at all. I haven't, like, watched any YouTube videos on it, or, like, I don't know. That's just not something I've done. I also have not casted anything to it yet in my normal usage. Like, not a single time have I been in the kitchen and, like, intentionally casted a video to it. I've cast music to it, obviously, but
I've casted video. It feels weird to, like, cast something from your 5.5-inch phone to a 6-inch phone. The 6-inch display.
Yeah, that's a good point. I didn't think about that. The display is not that much bigger than your average phone nowadays.
It supports closed captioning. That's nice.
Yeah. Oh, I forgot. A big part of the Home Hub is Home View, which is the smart home display or smart home control stuff. That's a big part of the device, and that's actually, like, my favorite thing. My use case personally has been, I have Nest Cam, so I have three. I have two Nest Cam IQs and a Nest Cam Outdoor right outside this window, actually. And I let the dog use the dog door all the time. And we have, like, the backyard kind of fenced off so that he can only access a certain area. And that Nest Cam keeps an eye on, like, a very specific area. And our dog is still pretty young. Like, he's, like, not even a year old yet. So he still chews on stuff and, like, sticks and stuff. So, like, what I've been doing for the last week or two is whenever I'm working in the kitchen, I'll let the dog go out in the backyard, and you can open Home View and go to cameras and click outdoor cam. And I just have the Nest Cam stream showing on the Home View, and I just keep an eye on the dog, make sure he's not killing himself. And I love that. Like, that's such a big deal to me. And another thing was, I mean, for me, the actual Nest thermostat is not that far away, physically speaking, from where my Home Hub is placed. So I haven't really used the thermostat control because it's like the Nest is right there. But I can definitely see how that would be useful, especially if you have your Home Hub in the bedroom. Because I don't know about you guys, but I think the Nest app is terrible and just needs so much work. I don't know, you know, anyone who's watching who uses Nest products on a daily basis. The Nest app is slow, and, like, the video feeds from the Nest cams are just jank. So I found the Home View experience on Home Hub to be really great with its integration with Nest. And I would love, if I had my Home Hub in my bedroom, being able to just swipe down thermostat, change temperature real quick. Mm-hmm. That's, you know, a killer feature, I think, for some people.
Oh, I have a question, actually. Would you recommend anybody buy a smart display from Lenovo or LG or JBL?
I haven't used either of them.
But at the end of the day, I think it comes down to display size. Again, design doesn't really matter.
Yeah, it's display size and audio. I think both the Lenovo and the JBL LinkView both have better audio than the Home Hub. Mm-hmm. So if audio is a big deal, especially in the case of the JBL, the JBL is kind of an interesting. It's actually in an interesting place because it's kind of like, you know, the Home Hub is between Home Mini and Home in terms of audio. Add the display. The JBL LinkView is like between the Home Hub and Google Home Max. And so it's filling a spot in the lineup that Google doesn't have, especially since we now know that the JBL LinkView and the Lenovo Smart Display are both going to get all the features
all the features.
Most of the features are coming to those. So, you know, there's no in the real world, there's no difference, despite the OS difference, there's no real difference between the Home Hub and the JBL Link View in terms of features. So, I mean, if you are looking for that product that Google doesn't sell, which is a product like the Home Hub with a good speaker like the Home Max, then, and it's kind of at a decent price point, you know, it's not as good as the Home Max, but it's, you know, it fills that void. If that's what you want, then I think the JBL Link View is for you.
But with smart displays, from our brief usage, do you think it's worth getting the screen size matter, basically? Yes, when it comes to photos, but as an assistive device, does it matter to have a big screen?
No, I don't think so. I think with the Home Hub being, the screen being as small as it is, it's like, I've not felt like I want it to be bigger.
Personally.
Yeah. One thing though, this is a very minor thing, but something I noticed, is that the device is, I find it to not be heavy enough sometimes.
Really?
So you go, one of the most common things that I do with it is I walk up to it and I drag down from the top to open the home view.
Interesting.
And what I find happening is I'll walk up to it and, you know, poke it to drag down. And what will happen is the device actually rocks back. Because my finger, you know, maybe I'm just too rough with it, but I'm trying to just use it like I normally would, but I touch it and it like rocks back a little bit because it's a small and heavy device. It's not heavy. So, you know, if that kind of, you know, I don't know, it's just one of those things. It's very minor, but I just noticed that it's like, I'm trying to use it and it's just like moving around or it's just like rocking over a little bit. And it's minor, but it's something worth noting. Yeah, so that's Home Hub. Long story short, it's really good. You should buy one. $150. It's the most, I mean, you won't regret spending $150 on it. You wouldn't regret spending $130 on the Google Home Hub, even in 2018, even though it's 2 years old now. Although I think it should be dropped down to 99 in context.
Oh, replaced, honestly.
Yeah, or updated.
Just make the Home Hub the default thing that people buy.
Yeah, maybe. Mm. I guess you could talk a little bit about, so we can move on. That's Home Hub. Just go buy one. Long story short, you know, it's a great digital photo frame. Even if you only use it as a photo frame, it's worth it, I think. Also, Google is preparing. So we spotted, this was kind of an exclusive. We spotted that Google is preparing Assistant for Europe, Europe's new Android app unbundling, thanks to the EU ruling, with a new app that was listed on the Play Store called Voice Action Services. So
So this is super interesting because of the 5 billion, as part of the 5 billion European antitrust fine, Google has to change their licensing agreements with various manufacturers. One of those things is that to get apps like Google Play or Google Drive, Play Music, etc., Google cannot mandate that Google Search and Google Chrome be installed, because that hurts third-party services. So without Google Search, you don't have Google Assistant. And as everybody knows, Assistant is their big push. So there's no Google Assistant in traditional sense, but the company is still offering basic voice control so that you can say, like, send a text message, make a calendar event, etc., etc. And it's called Voice Action Services. It looks identical to Assistant, but it's just, it's basic, it's everything without the ability to make a web search, which makes sense since Google, the European Union doesn't want Google Search on there. In a lot of ways, I think like more privacy conscious users might want to like sideload this app because it gets all the voice commands, but for the people that don't trust Google, you have all the voice interaction. So it's, in the grand scheme of things, it's like a mediumly interesting. But this is that we're starting to see big changes to Android as a result.
Yeah, this is probably only the first of many changes we'll probably see over the next couple of years. Do you know if you mentioned that it might be attractive for people that want to have or maintain greater privacy and still be Android users, which if you're really obsessed with privacy at a super strict level, then just don't use Android.
Yeah.
But I think, do we know that this app doesn't track, like Google keeps a history of all of your interactions with Google Assistant. Do we know whether or not it actually keeps a history or?
It keeps a history. According to, we were able to tear down the app, and it still asks for your activity during the setup process. It still asks for all those things to be useful. But I guess the privacy angle is more from not having Google search for the people that don't trust all those cataloging.
Right.
Your research terms, the broader web. But yeah, that's what I meant by privacy angle.
For sure.
But I guess the question is, do we expect like Samsung to like release a Amazon Fire Phone in like the next few months because of this new freedom? Or do they start selling phones that only have the Galaxy App Store? Or is everybody going to play nice?
Yeah, it's a good question. Speaking of Amazon, I love the thought experiment of thinking about, you know, whether or not it would be good for them to buy Essential. we were talking about that this week, and man, in so many ways, it seems like it makes so much sense.
Mm-hmm. Culture doesn't fit. I don't think Andy Rubin's culture fits in Amazon.
Yeah, probably not. But yeah, going back to what you were saying, it is really interesting. I mentioned this, you know, last week when we were talking about this just bigger sea change. Maybe that was last week. I can't remember. You know, the bigger sea change of what's going on with Android. It'll be interesting to see if Samsung, you know, tries to push their own app store even more. And not just Samsung, but other, you know, OEMs. Are we going to see a lot of what's happening in China happen in Europe? And it seems like the answer is yes. It seems like what's going to happen is a lot of these companies are just going to have their own versions of a lot of things and we're going to see a lot of Google's apps and services just disappear from these phones. And that's interesting in the context of Google kind of directly competing with them, because, you know, with the Pixel, they're directly competing, but a lot of their partners have still, in Europe at least, still had the entire suite of Google apps.
Yeah.
And that might change. It's going to be interesting from our perspective as like journalists and reviewers. It's like when we're reviewing phones for Europe now, it's going to be it's going to be a point on the review to be like, this doesn't come with Google Apps in some cases.
When it happens, yeah.
When it happens. Right.
It's good. Yeah. But for the consumer, is it going to be confusing? That's like a really big question moving forward. Google previously was able to enforce what they call compatibility agreements, which means that you can't fork Android if you're using Google services. And now we could see tiers of phones, Google phones and regular Android phones. And it's going to be really interesting to see whether regular consumers pick that up and they're buying. Or if Samsung is going to do something crazy and market it like $100 cheaper.
Yeah.
Track people.
Yeah, I do say, I do think that one thing about normal users is that they tend to use whatever apps are pre-installed on their phones.
Yes. Oh yeah, they do.
Like the average person is not going to buy a Samsung phone that comes with a default email app that's not Gmail and then go to the Play Store and download Gmail. They're just going to use whatever app is on the phone and log into it with their Gmail account.
I think Google's bigger concern is Chrome. We could see a resurgence of mobile browsers. I know Firefox is doing a lot of privacy-focused stuff. I think Opera is still around. We could see Microsoft Edge, Windows, whatever it's called, try to like market its way in with deals. So this is going to be a real interesting time for Google's core businesses.
Yeah, more competition is good in that. I mean, I think that, you know, Chrome can only be pushed to be better. You know, make people want to go out of their way to install Chrome on their phones.
Yeah.
Like that's when, only a good thing for end users.
Yeah. Like when Chrome on Windows came out, there was like Chrome was the upstart. And
yep.
Now we could see that happen all over again. And like you said, it's exciting.
Yeah. All right. Well, we're kind of nearing our 1 hour. What other stories do you think did you feel were notable this week besides those three big things?
Another weird advertising thing was Google doing a Chromebooks promotion with Game of Thrones. That was very cringy.
I have absolutely zero thoughts on that because I've never watched a single episode of Game of Thrones.
You ain't missing much. It's just a controversial statement. And just today, as Tim Cook gave his privacy keynote in Brussels,
yes.
Google made it easier to control and delete your data on all its apps, but it's starting with Google Search. In the nav drawer of every single Google app, every single major Google app, you'll be able to delete like search terms or like navigation requests or whatnot in the future. And we're starting, that privacy shift is starting to happen.
Yeah, I there's no way that was a coincidence.
No way.
The timing of that. I wonder if Google allowed users to just check a box to just be not tracked at all, I wonder what percentage of users would go out of their way to find that setting and enable it.
The key is out of the way.
Like, make that an option to just not be tracked, period. And, you know, make it super buried.
I guess.
So that most people will never find it, but anyone who's like really obsessive about wanting their privacy can just check it. And checking it also means you lose XYZ feature. Like, yeah. That would be, you know, it's like you'd be giving up functionality.
Yeah. And that's another interesting question, whether people care about whether they can, how much value they assign to functionality and usefulness versus privacy. As we've mentioned before, this is like such a big issue going forward, especially with Google.
It seemed like Apple's strategy there with that has been to let Google be a couple years ahead on those things. So like, I mean, one example that comes to mind is Google Photos and identifying and categorizing your photos based on what the AI actually sees in them. So being able to search like, you know, cat or whatever and see cat photos. Google Photos was like a year or two ahead of that, of Apple on that. And they did all of that computation in the cloud. So you had to upload your photos to Google Photos for that to happen.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was server side. And then, you know, Apple was like way behind and Google Photos got, you know, I think Google Photos did an amazing job of really picking up lots of fresh new Google users because it was just so far ahead of the competition and it made so much sense for a lot of people. And such a great product. Props to the whole Google Photos team. It's like one of Google's best products ever, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. But like, you know, Apple 2 years later managed to do the same exact thing, but on device and, you know, completely preserving privacy. And so, you know, that's just one example, but it seems like they're letting, and I mean, a lot of the computational photography stuff too, like that's not necessarily a privacy implication, I don't think, but Apple's also a year or two behind on that. So I can't tell, sometimes I can't tell if Apple's like actually behind on AI or if they are just super hardline about not doing any AI related things that are going to have privacy implications and just like being okay that Google gets such a lead on those things. Like, I mean, Siri is another example where it's like Siri will probably eventually catch up with Google Assistant.
Yeah.
Without, you know, while still maintaining Apple's hardline, you know, on privacy. It's hard to determine, you know, what features really require giving up privacy and which ones don't. But I don't know. It just seems like Apple's always a year or two behind and they eventually catch up, but they just do it in a way that doesn't, you know, have privacy implications.
Taking a look at Google Photos, at Photos and voice assistants, iOS and Android. So Google Photos, there's so many iOS users that, okay, to get Google Photos, you have to consciously download it. And that's a thing that's happening and actively happening. Google's right. advertising about
it's like Google Chrome. Photos.
Yeah, definitely. But then there's Google Assistant, which is a standalone iOS app that it's not a hit or anything like that.
And
is that a reflection of people not really caring about assistance yet or enough?
In that case, it's a reflection of the fact that Assistant can't be directly integrated with the operating system. If the Assistant, for instance, if you could download that third-party Google Assistant app and it could actually swap out the hardware shortcut with Google Assistant on the lock screen, then I think Google Assistant would probably be seeing downloads as, you know, up there with Google Photos, you know, because it would make sense. You know, it's kind of another example, actually, is Gboard. It's not as much of good of an example. But I think Gboard actually does pretty well because you can actually swap it out as the default. And the big thing that Gboard brings is, you know, obviously the googly stuff, but also swiping on the keyboard. And I think Google's approach with Gboard is actually fascinating because they basically copied the iOS keyboard. Mm-hmm. It feels, when you type on it, it feels exactly like the stock iOS keyboard, but they added swiping and they added, you know, all the Google stuff. And so Gboard, I feel like, is better than the iOS keyboard in every way, and you can set it as default. And so I do that on any iPhone that I use.
Gboard as a way to get assistant in front of users is very interesting. Imagine if they start doing like reminders in a suggestion strip. Well, from assistant. That's a promising way to investigate. But Gboard's a good point. When they can, which is a whole broad discussion about Apple opening up iOS to third-party apps and setting defaults, when they can, they will switch like Photos and Gboard, and other times they just don't.
Yeah. All right, well, I think that pretty much... I don't think there's that much more that happened this week. And in terms of the amount of news, it was a big week. But in terms of the amount of noteworthy talking points, there weren't that many big things. One thing before we wrap up the show, I wanted to touch on a little bit of housekeeping. We're going to have the show on Wednesday afternoons from now until indefinitely, just to, you know, see how it goes. We've been doing Friday afternoons, Friday around 3 or 4 p.m. Eastern time since we started, but we're now on episode 30, and it seems like the last couple weeks our Wednesday afternoon shows have done really, really well. On top of that, it's just really nice doing this in the middle of the work week and not having to worry about doing the post edits and stuff and uploading everything on a Saturday morning and yada, yada, yada. So we're going to just try this out and see how it goes. We really appreciate any feedback anyone has on when we should be doing the show, the format of the show, the time of the show. Just let us know. Send us feedback. Send us email. I'm at steven@9to5mac.com. Abner's Abner@9to5mac.com. Not complicated. Send us your thoughts. Let us know what you think about the show. If there's quality problems, video, audio, we're working on things week by week. I'm still pushing Abner to get a new microphone. Slowly but surely, we're trying to really nail this down and perfect this show and make it as enjoyable for you as listeners to tune into every week. And we'll be back next Wednesday for episode 31. Until then, you can tune into Alphabet Scoop here every week. We record this podcast every Wednesday and publish on all your favorite podcast platforms, either Wednesday evening or Thursday morning. You can tune into that in audio format at iTunes and Apple Podcasts, Pocket Casts, Google Podcasts, Google Play. And you can also listen over at 95google.com directly and check out our live stream. For the last few weeks, several weeks actually, we've been pretty steady with a 4 p.m. Eastern time show. So around 4 p.m. Eastern time every week on Wednesdays for the next week, for the next several weeks, for the foreseeable future. That's where we'll be. So we'll see you next week.